Well,
this is Peter Fisher, and this is episode 9 of sequence 2 of the Fisher Files. And tonight we're going to be talking about teaching, how to do it and how to do it well, and why it's a good thing to do.
Because I can't be around you and not be with you if you refuse to come with me. I'll go it alone.
We've been talking a lot about careers and things to do to advance your career, and the assumption always is that one wants to have, or that you, the listener, wants to have an academic career, which the highest and most exalted position is that of professor. And one thing that professors do is teach. Now, this was really the original sole duty of professors, and in the turn of the century in this country was the founding of the great first-rate research universities, starting really with Johns Hopkins, but through the wars, and especially in the post-war era, it's become much more common for the major universities to have a significant research component in addition to their educational part. Now, many professors treat teaching as a detail or an unpleasant activity that is sort of a rent that you have to pay to have the academic freedom that we all enjoy. And, of course, I think this is completely the wrong attitude. I think if you really aren't interested in teaching, and I'll come to exactly what teaching is in a moment, you really have no place in a university. I'll just say that categorically. There are lots of other things you can do in lab and industry. So if you're not seriously interested in teaching and more broadly interacting with the younger people, you should really just resign your position and go do something else that you want to do. Now, when we talk about teaching, we generally think about being in a classroom or in a lecture hall and expounding our views and our knowledge to students. And that certainly is a component, but teaching happens a lot of other places. Teaching basically happens, in my view, anytime you interact with students, number one, or colleagues. And number two, if you're a good teacher, it goes both ways. And you're constantly learning from the people you're trying to teach, or your students and colleagues. But really, the main concern that I have tonight is since we're talking about career advancement, is, you know, how do you organize an academic class, particularly in the sciences, in a manner that is efficient and pleasurable, and pleasant or pleasurable for both you and the students. And not surprisingly, the real key to this is preparation. Typically, in the course of a term, you will give close to 30 lectures. If you're the lecture instructor, or lead about 30 recitation sections if you're a recitation instructor. This is a lot, and it's not something you're going to do in real time. One reason I feel uniquely qualified to talk about teaching is that in my 15 years of doing it, I've completely spanned the spectrum from, you know, absolutely miserable to winning teaching prizes. So I think I have a pretty good idea of at least what doesn't work. And one thing that doesn't work is trying to keep a lecture or two ahead of the students. This winds up with kind of a course that meanders around, because you haven't really thought through where you're starting and where you're going. you may have developed an outline before, but really, you until you flesh it out with, you know, actual blackboard by blackboard lectures, you really don't know where you're going. So the first time you teach a course, and most universities will give you a tour of duty of 3 terms teaching the same course. So the first term, you really have to begin preparing the course well in advance. So at the start of the course, you have a rough draft of every single lecture, basically every single thing you're going to say and every single thing you're going to write on the blackboard. And in addition, you have a rough draft of all of the assignments, even if they are not problems of your creation, but problems that come out of the book. Most books and most topics have far more problems than you can possibly assign. And so you really need a very clear idea of where you're going with the course so that you can assign meaningful problems. Simply doing it the night before and haphazardly slopping down a few problems just won't work. So rule number one is really prepare well in advance. Rule number two is you really need to know your audience. Now, generally, you have a pretty good idea of where the class fits in the major program, you know, whether it's an introductory freshman course or a senior level course or whatever. But even if you've taught quite a bit, you need to know specifically what kind of students you have. And you can learn a lot by talking to the people who have taught them the term before. You need to know their capabilities, and you need to constantly be adjusting the course so that the students are challenged and not overwhelmed. And frankly speaking, they're pretty good about telling you this if you're the recitation instructor and you simply ask them. So if you're a lecturer, it's a very good idea to be constantly talking to the recitation instructors about whether or not the students are getting it. For this reason, it's really important to have a weekly staff meeting for the course where everybody gets into the same room. I find generally that a half hour or even 15 minutes is enough to kind of go through everything that's going on in the usual course through the middle of the term, away from exams or anything. But you need to meet, because that's your feedback. Now, if you're the lecturer, you do learn all kinds of things about presentation, writing well on the blackboard, pacing, and all of those things. And there are many, many resources at any university to help you with this, so I'm not going to spend too much time dwelling on it. The main thing that's important is to finish on time, and finish on time without hurrying. Because it's really very annoying to the students to see someone, you know, rip through about 15 minutes worth of material in 3 minutes. In fact, the 3 minutes overtime, because they haven't prepared and haven't practiced their lecture. So that means you really have to practice every single lecture, and you have to practice it the second year you teach the course, the third year you teach the course. Every time you teach the course, you have to practice the lecture. You know, that's why it's really work to teach a class well. The other key thing, aside from preparation, is respect. And you have to have respect for the students, and they have to have respect for you. Now, don't confuse respect with fear or awe or anything like that. What respect really means is that they know what's expected of them, and you know, and they know what to expect from you. And those things should be reasonable. They should know that you're going to finish the course on time. They should know that their homework is going to be graded and returned to them with solutions in a timely fashion. They should know that the textbook is chosen at a reasonable level. they should know that they could come and talk to you about the course. On the other hand, you should know that you can sit in your office on a Tuesday afternoon when you're not teaching and not be interrupted by a student. You should know that the students are not going to complain about their grading and try to wheedle back extra points. You should know that the students are going to attend class on time. And you should know that they're going to make an honest attempt to complete their work. So it's very, very important in the early stages of the course, starting from the very first day, that you begin making it clear what you expect and what you are willing to put up with. Another word for this are boundaries. You really have to lay out the boundaries of the course. For example, it's important that you have office hours if you're the lecturer or recitation instructor. But those office hours should not be any time students feel like coming and seeing you. They should be specific hours, and during that time you should be totally available for the students. That does not mean that you're sitting in your office working on something else, talking to someone on the phone, and stop what you're doing when the students come. It means you should be there waiting. I found it really best for my office hours just to get a tutoring room and, you know, take a magazine and just be there, not doing anything else except maybe reading the magazine when the students showed up. This conveys to them the air that you're taking the office hours seriously and it's their time, not time that you're giving them away from something else. You can get away with only having one or two office hours a week if you make it really meaningful in this way. The other thing I should mention is that a really good time to have your office hours is the hour or two before problem sets are due. You always get a bunch of students and you have some lively discussion. Now, in these days of email, you should encourage students to email you with questions. But again, you have to make it clear when and how you're going to respond. If students email you and simply never hear from you, you're not respecting them in the way they deserve. On the other hand, students should not feel like they can send you, you know, four-page long, very detailed questions any time and expect a response. So you really have to decide in advance of the course what you think is willing and communicate that in the very beginning. All this said, one of the really important things is on the very first day of class to have a sheet that you give the students that has all of this information on it. And you should really kind of tell them that that's the contract between them and you. For example, another important thing has to do with problem sets. The problem sets should be graded, the grades recorded, and the problem sets returned, certainly within a week, preferably less. Similarly for examinations. Anything longer than a week, and the students have really forgotten, the material is irrelevant, and you really haven't done your job for them. So all of these things sound really draconian and harsh, but if you set them up like this from the very beginning, then everybody knows what to expect, and as I've mentioned before, the big stresses in life come from uncertainty, not knowing when your recitation instructor will be available, not knowing when you're getting your exam back, not knowing where if the instructor is going to be there for office hours. That's what causes stress. The rest of it is actually rather pleasurable because you're spending a lot of time talking to someone who's interested in what you're interested in, wants to learn from you, and all in all, that's a really pleasurable experience. You're not going to get that from most of your colleagues, I'm sad to say. Most of your colleagues, you know, they're really concerned about what they're doing, which is, of course, the most important thing in the world, and not really too concerned with you. But students are just endlessly fascinated with faculty, how you got there, where you went to school, what research you do, and spending a lot of time talking to them is a good thing. But you've just got to structure it so that it doesn't spill over into everything else. So you really need to put really clear, sharp boundaries around all around your teaching. And within those boundaries, you're totally there, you're totally engaged. Outside of the boundaries, what you do for your teaching is very, very optional. Now, one thing that I think I'm a little bit different with about MIT is deadlines. I used to feel that deadlines were very, very important and a way of, you know, really maintaining the serious tone of the course. And so I had pretty much a standing policy that I didn't accept late work. Now, of course, I very frequently accepted late work. And I felt, well, you know, that's kind of my right as the instructor. The students need to learn about scheduling and planning ahead and so on. But after some years, I've kind of reached the conclusion that in many ways that is really not very respectful of the students. It's important for me that I recognize that, like me, they lead very complicated lives with lots of competing demands, and that sometimes it's going to be very difficult to meet an arbitrarily imposed deadline. What do I mean by arbitrarily imposed deadline? What I mean is this. For example, in junior lab, we have lab reports, and I might say they're due at midnight on Friday. Now, I get the lab reports midnight at Friday. I get 7 out of 8. The 8th student sends an email and says, I'm not done with my lab report, and can I have another 5 hours? Now, I've said that it's due at midnight, but there's really no reason it needs to be at midnight, because I'm not going to sit there and grade it on midnight on Friday. I might wait till Saturday, I might wait till Sunday, might even be Monday before I sit down to grade it. So why shouldn't students have extra time if they need it? So I've adopted a policy where I tell students that, you know, I want them to hand the work in at a certain time so that I know it's there. If they need to be hand the work in later, they should tell me, and they should tell me exactly when they plan to hand it in. And if that's okay, you know, meaning they're not delaying me, that's fine. If they're delaying me, I will tell them an alternative time, and they have to meet that. I just really don't think that, you know, the MIT and me, I'm not the Internal Revenue Service. You know, I don't need it by midnight on April 15th. I'm willing to be flexible. But in this flexibility, there has to be negotiation and then an agreement on a new time, and that has to be really stuck to. So what you do is up to you. But I think it's important that we recognize that our students are very busy and that our deadlines are frequently very, very arbitrary. I mentioned before that it's very, very important to get the work back to them quickly. It's a feedback loop. Students need to know how they're doing, and they do frequently look at their work and look at the solution sets, particularly preparing for exams. And so I really feel that the tighter that feedback loop is, the better it is for everyone. So I do recommend trying to get work graded and returned to them. So, you know, that's a lot of kind of formal bureaucratic thing. An important thing about teaching well is to recognize that teaching is really a two-way street, that at the very least, if you're lecturing, you're looking at your students and seeing if you see the shining light of pure intelligence in their eye, or the dull glisten of boredom in their eyes. And in that sense, it is two-way, because they're communicating back to you. You should really communicate with them a lot more and find means to do it, either in office hours or by hanging around and talking to them a little bit before and after lecture. It's the best way to find out how you're doing. The course evaluations at the end are really nice, but they are completely haphazard, and by then it's too late. So you know, and they won't just tell you by email if they think you're really screwing up. But if you talk to them and, you know, in office hours, before lecture, after lecture, even during lecture, and by inviting questions, you'll get some sense of what they're getting. And really, if you're up there lecturing and you're steaming along, going through your well-rehearsed, well-practiced lecture, and you look out at the class and, you know, you really see that they're either not looking at you or they're just kind of sitting there with their jaws hanging open, you've just got to stop and say, look, what's wrong? Are you getting this? And, you know, very frequently you'll find that you said something wrong or you misstated something or, you know, just some little thing went wrong and you can correct it and move on. If you don't stop and take the time, number one, you'll just lose them and lose their respect. And number two, you know, you'll just wind up with a surly, malcontented bunch of kids, which is no fun at all. So really be looking at them and talking to them and seeing what they're getting. More deeply, if you have the time, listen to them and learn about them. They're generally a pretty interesting bunch, and they'll come with their own ideas, which will frequently stimulate why, and, you know, how you're teaching the course. The very first term I had at MIT, I had a couple of students who were really, really interested in radar, and I was teaching electricity and magnetism. I was a recitation instructor, and they kept coming and asking questions about radar. And, you know, at a certain point, it really triggered my interest. And, it turned out MIT has a tremendous history in radar, and it's very important. It made MIT what it was, what it is in many ways. And you only get that by freeing up some time to really kind of talk to the students. Anything you can bring in from your research and your experience is very valuable, because those are things that you can really talk about with, you know, some passion and interest, and the students will be uniformly appreciative of that. Now, as I mentioned, learning happens a lot of different places, and you'll have graduate students, and one of your jobs is to really teach graduate students. Now, what you'll teach them is, in large measure, how to conduct your research. But, you know, you should also take the time to prepare short little mini lectures or expositions about things that you think they should know that they're not going to learn in class. This varies a lot from field to field. But the undergraduate curriculum is only a few years, and most subjects these days are fairly broad, and if you think about it, there are probably a lot of things you wish you had been taught when you were a student. And it's really important to take the time and teach them to your graduate students. I typically try to have a weekly meeting with my students, and a part of that, I very consciously sometimes try to spend explaining something to them. Frequently they'll explain something to me, and it's okay if that wanders off of the, you know, the strict what are we doing right now time. Another thing, good time to do this is in a group meeting, to sort of take turns teaching each other things. It's really much more interesting than a lot of the technical discussions that go on. And when I talk about how to run a group meeting, I think a major part of the group meeting is really about that, and rather than, you know, some tedious discussion between two people about an endless technical detail. So learning happens all over the place. Another very important place I learn things is at lunch, particularly the Popolardo luncheons that we have at MIT. Very frequently, if you just relax and, you know, not talk about, you know, silly things that are happening around the university, although you have to do that too, but and listen to people and engage, you'll find that the most unlikely people have very interesting things to say that will affect your research and affect your outlook. So around a university, learnings happens everywhere, and you really have to open yourself to it. I should say a little bit about recitation instructors, because I don't think MIT really gives them a whole lot of guidance. I know Lori Breslow used to. I don't know anymore. The role of the recitation instructor is, you know, not to give their own version of the lecture that the students just saw. It's not to do the problem sets. And it's not there simply to answer questions. A good recitation instructor's job is to very quickly, like in the first 5 minutes of class, find out what it is the students need help with, and frequently the students don't know, and then sort of in real time come up with help for the students in, usually in the form of kind of a Socratic dialogue. Recitations are really not time to deliver long lectures, and if you find yourself talking for more than like 5 minutes in a recitation, you should really ask yourself what you're doing. So what I learned from Lori, which actually works pretty well, is you go in and, you know, there'll always be a problem set due or something like that, and say, okay, you know, we've only got 50 minutes here. Let's just make an agenda of questions. So you just do this like in 2 minutes, just ask the students to give you all the questions they have and try to write them down in some condensed form. And then go through them and kind of group them into related topics. And then go and address them one at a time. This is really valuable because, number one, it really gets the students what they need, rather than you just preparing something and lecturing on it. Number two, it makes students feel like it's their time and that they're in the driver's seat. And that's important for them because very frequently they feel like they just aren't, that they're just totally at the mercy of this, you know, big academic system that they're embedded in. You know, which of course they are, but they don't need to feel like that every second of every day. The other reason it's important is it's kind of fun, because, you know, you go in there and you've got this body of knowledge and, you know, it's like you're having an oral exam. You're really going to be tested. Now, I've said several times that recitation shouldn't be about lecturing. I'm going to back off from that a little bit. I think, you know, it's valuable if you have something to say and want to prepare it, that you should. But you should make sure that the students feel like, you know, their questions have been answered first before they get into your stuff. Now, there are a lot of ways that you can save time in lecture or recitation, time which is very, very valuable these days. So, for example, one thing I've done a few times is if I screwed something up in lecture, rather than go back over it again, I write it up. I, you know, write, you know, sort of a couple of pages of explanation of what was wrong and how it should be, Xeroxed it and give it to the class. Or now you can scan it and email it to the class. So don't be afraid to use things like that to save time in lecture or in recitation. Don't feel like you have to, if you want to communicate with the class, that you have to produce a beautiful LaTeX document. You know, simple cursive handwriting with a pen on paper, you know, put your name and the date on the top, put the title across the top of the page, and write what you have to say. It takes far less time. You can do it on a bus. This penchant of word processing absolutely everything is really just unnecessary. Write it up, scan it, and email it to the students, or Xerox it and hand it out to them. One thing I've actually been thinking about is I have a blackboard in my office, and if I could set up a camera so that I could do a derivation on the blackboard and take pictures of it and distribute it either in the form of the video or in the form of a podcast where I can display subsequent equations on the iPod screen. I thought that might be valuable. Although it'll take some time to set up, and I don't want to waste a lot of time trying to get something new going right in the middle of the term. But there are all these kind of wonderful new technologies around, and don't be afraid to use them. So to sort of summarize, you know, really the main things I have to say is that the teaching's all about preparation, and that the execution should be fun and easy and sort of graceful. Finishing on time is very important and more largely a sign of respect for the students, and you should take pains to make sure the students you understand that you respect them, and that the having a really tight feedback loop is important. So if you are ahead of the game at a lecture and you feel comfortable and confident about it, you'll just have a much better time with the students. And no matter where you are, you find that the students are really kind of the best aspect of the place. They're, always between 18 and 22, always eager and always interesting and excited, as you get older and older and duller and dimmer. So it's one of the best things about a university. In fact, you could argue that it really is the university. Interesting articles from a recent science issue. One of them is the discovery of a new cat in central China. They photographed the legendary Chinese mountain cat, which hadn't been seen for about 100 years. Some researchers set up a camera to photograph the cat, and you can see it in the 31st of August edition of the cat. It is probably endangered, but there is at least one of them. There's also another interesting little article about pulling cork out of wine. It comes more easily out of the bottle if you twist it, and apparently this had been a long-standing argument about why this happened. This was done in France, of course, and they analyzed how the cork has to deform. It actually twists both internally and externally. And there is actually an article in Proceedings of Royal Society A, which I'll post. It goes on to explain that what you really want on your corkscrew is something that butts up against the screw and forces the cork to rotate. In Nature, in the August 30th edition, there's a kind of a strange article. It's actually a big two-page spread, the title of which is Air Force Had Early Warning of Pulsars. And it's the story of Charles Schisler, who was a sergeant manning a radar station on the distant early warning line, who noticed that in the course of the day, at a certain time that changed by 4 minutes each day, a pulse would appear on his planned position radar indicator. And he knew that corresponded, that 4 minutes is the time that a star rises, the difference in times that a star rises from day to day. And what he was actually seeing was the Crab Nebula, which is a supernova remnant and has a very large pulsar in it. And so he kept a very careful catalog and eventually had several dozen sources. And of course, this guy is a sergeant in the Army looking at radar. And so all of this was secret and just recently declassified. And he did this before Hewish, who was famous as receiving the Nobel Prize for first observation of a pulsar. There's another article I'm going to post a link to. This is something that I was been thinking about ever since Katrina. The anniversary, the two-year anniversary, was a couple of weeks ago. This is an article by John McPhee from his book, Man's Control of Nature, which is four essays that he wrote about how man attempts to control nature. Now, McPhee is a first-rate science writer and essayist, and one of his articles was on the Mississippi River, and his basic conclusion was that the Mississippi River is doing a number of things. One of it is it's slowly silting, so the bottom of the river is getting higher and higher. And as that happens, what it wants to do is jump its banks and find a new course, and that's typical of an old river. And the Mississippi has switched course many times through the eons, in the Atchafalaya Basin, and it wants to again. But the Army Corps of Engineers has just been building the levees higher and higher, with the net result that now the bottom of the Mississippi is about 15 or 20 feet above the bottom of the surrounding land. So if you sit on Jackson Square or down in the French Quarter and you see a 500-foot freighter go by, the keel of that freighter is actually above your head. Now this is a battle you're gonna lose. And I've been thinking about this ever since reading a number of articles and op-ed pieces written on the second year anniversary of Katrina about how the flawed design of the levees of the Army Corps of Engineers. I haven't heard any discussion about, what are we gonna do about the bigger problem, which is that this thing is silting up, and eventually, the levees are going to be too high to successfully maintain. Maybe those are things that are just politically impossible to talk about. But I was actually thinking of writing an op-ed piece of my own and sending it to the New York Times. Anyway, I'll post the McPhee article, and if anyone reads it, I'd be interested to hear what you have to think. For this week. Next week I'll be talking about vacations, probably. I'm thinking about it a lot because I didn't get one this year, and I'm feeling really crappy and tired and in a bad mood most of the time. So I think it's a good time to address the issue of vacations. And until then, I'd like to thank Sheila Holzer Marston and John Marston and Sean Thompson and Maynard Galinas for help with computing, and Bonna Newman and Homer Reed. And until next week, have a good time in Cambridge or wherever you are.
Kapua ilunae no kapa ake a he makua e e e a Kapuana, yeah, Kalanika, Vika, hey, no.